Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 85% of American parents believe it's important to tell their kids they're smart, and 85% of American parents may be wrong. In recent years, the self-esteem movement, born in the 1960s, has run into some serious opposition when it comes to scholars who think about raising kids. You think telling your sons and daughters they're brilliant, wondrous, smart is a gift? Maybe not. Newer research suggests that encouraging kids to strive, to try, to grow is the way to really fire up their engines, that a shower of praise can be paralyzing. Up next on Point, kids' self-esteem and the caution not to praise too much. We're going to hear this hour from Stanford psychology professor Carol Dweck. You may have heard her this week on NPR's Morning Edition, talking about mindsets that really motivate children. But first, for a parent's eye view of the tensions over self-esteem and child-rearing, we're turning to writer, keen observer, and father of two, Poe Bronson. We've talked with Poe over the years about Silicon Valley and American aspirations. He's the author of The Nudist on the Late Shift and Why Do I Love These People and What Should I Do with My Life? He's got the cover story in this week's New York Magazine headlined How Not to Talk to Your Kids, The Inverse Power of Praise. Poe Bronson, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure to work with you, Tom.
So, speaking of working with, you've got a couple of kids, what, 5 and 2 now? You're out in that swirl of parents trying to do the right thing. Before you stumbled onto this, what were you seeing out there, Poe?
I soaked up the ether, Tom, of that you can't praise your kids too much, you know. I was very proud as the son of a reserved and quiet father to not be that kind of person, to be the opposite. I mean, me and my cousin were so proud. We remember our dads, you know, never praised us. Were very tough on us. Mm. And we were so proud of that we've turned the tables and we get to lavish, endless sort of love and praise and ego-boosting self-attribution statements on our children. And I didn't have a conscious mechanism for why I was doing it. Mm. And I particularly noticed that with my 5-year-old son, who I was doing homework with and teaching to read over the last year, mm-hmm. that I was definitely telling him he was smart. I'd say it to him maybe three times a night, just dropping, you know, "You're so smart, kiddo," whenever he got something right. Mm. And why did I do it? I don't think I know. I think I just soaked it up from the parenting ether.
And that ether is all over the place. Describe in the circles that you and your kids run in among the parents that you watch raising their kids, the evidence of this kind of what you're almost describing here as a self-esteem promotion obsession.
Yeah, there's a sense that smartness, is parents feel smart. And there's a sense that the children are going to enter a world where smartness is the most valued attribute. And you don't want your kid to begin that arms race thinking he's outgunned. And as a parent, every parent watches their toddler look at the world and very quickly begin to divide it into things I'm good at and things I'm not. And the children will look at some task and without even trying say, "Oh, I can't do that." And as a parent, you're really frustrated. The children won't try certain foods. They won't walk into certain rooms. And we imagine that our praise is this angel on the shoulder telling them, "You're innately great. You can do it." And if we instill this idea in the sort of underneath this sort of psychological armor in their heads, that they will not be cautious, that they will attack the world freely. And I was shocked to find out that that's absolutely not true.
And we're going to hear from Carol Dweck, who's one of those who's putting out a kind of new message here. But the old message of self-esteem and the promotion of self-esteem, the central importance of it, holy grail, it's been around for quite a while now, as you remind us, Poe Bronson, all the way back to maybe 1969. You look to the publication of The Psychology of Self-Esteem. How did that roll out?
this book on the psychology of self-esteem was penned in 1969, and it became enormously popular. And Nathaniel Brandon argued that self-esteem was the most important and essential determinant in any person as to how they were going to succeed in the world. And it really got a boost in 1984 when a California legislature passed a self-esteem task force. And this surprisingly got an enormous amount of press and became a sort of bellwether. And there was this promise that, particularly when it came to, say, people and women in poverty and young girls that were having too much sex, that if we could give them self-esteem, it would be this sort of secret ingredient, like the X factor. And if we could manufacture positive and high self-esteem for all these kids, incredible results were going to follow. And self-esteem became one of the most studied phenomena in all of psychological history. From 1970 to 2000, there were 15,000 scholarly articles looking at self-esteem, trying to find its correlation between self-esteem and just about everything, especially grades and performance and career performance.
And you write that during that time, in your words, Poe, anything potentially damaging to kids' self-esteem was axed, competitions frowned upon, soccer coaches stopped counting goals, handing out trophies to everyone, teachers threw out their red pencils, criticism was replaced with ubiquitous, even undeserved praise.
Absolutely. And when I say teachers threw out the red pencils, I don't mean that like metaphorically. I mean literally, teachers were told red is too negative, and you need to make your marks on students' papers with a blue pen or a pink pen or a green pen. I mean, there's a school district in Massachusetts that has kids jumping rope without a rope, Tom. Mm. You know, we've gone from jumping without a safety net to jumping rope without a rope, in all to protect kids from failure. And some of the science of this shows that kids would do fine if they never encounter failure, but inevitably kids do encounter hardship and failure, and the self-esteem movement wasn't preparing kids for what to do when they hit that failure.
Now, I've got to say, though, and we'll look at what some alternatives might be, but you know, I'm a parent. I've been around this track. I clearly see there are many ways to get there, but in the end, doesn't self-esteem matter? Don't you want kids who have a sense of confidence as they face the world, or are you drawing a distinction between confidence and self-esteem?
There's a difference between self-efficacy and self-esteem. And from the very beginning, in the mid-80s, when self-esteem boomed in the Washington, D.C. school district, the students there were number two in the country in self-esteem about their math abilities, but were last in the country about their actual math abilities. They believed they were good at math, but they were actually the worst at math. And there's a real difference between, you know, just sort of generally believing you're good and actually having the skills to do it. Today, there's a gap in high school students as seniors. 94% believe they will enroll in college. Mm. The next fall, only 64% actually do it. And that gap between high school students' ambition and the reality has never been higher. Consider that in 1976, 50% of high school students hoped to enroll in college someday, and 50% exactly did. Their ambition was aligned with reality. And today, we have instilled students with hopes, but not with the skills to actually enact those hopes.
Now, you're not saying give up on those skills, those ambitions, far from it, but you're pointing to another way. And again, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Carol Dweck, who's one of the big thinkers about this. But you are saying that all that praise could end up paralyzing. You described that paralysis of kids' fear to do this or that, but why? Why would praise be paralyzing?
Well, because a parent thinks I'm just being encouraging. Why would that do anything to a kid? But it's actually perceived as pressure. Through the constancy of praise, children begin to understand. My parents always saying, you're doing so well. And the kid begins to understand the parent has very high expectations of me. And so certain studies of praise show that the liberal use of praise in a classroom leads to students always checking with the teacher with their eyes, answering questions with the intonation of a question mark so the teacher can also correct them at the end. And I had one high school English teacher in New Jersey tell me that she can easily spot the kids who are overpraised at home. They're absolutely fixated upon their grade and not really learning from the work.
Is there something wrong with high expectations, Poe? Are you saying let go of that?
I don't think so. In fact, one of the studies shows that a psychologist Wolf Uwe Meyer did a series of studies in which students would watch another student get praised by a teacher. And it turns out that children under age of 7 interpret praise at face value. But at beyond that age, they begin to unspin it just the way we unspin political messages. So that by the age of 12, a child watching another student get praised will assume if that student got praised, it's not because he did something really well. It's probably because the teacher's worried about him and he lacks ability. So getting praise is a sign that you're not really doing well. And in fact, the opposite is true for criticism, that if you criticize a child, the child will think, wow, this teacher actually thinks I can do better.
And you're not saying, you're clearly not saying give up on the kids here. We've just got a minute before the break. But
right.
In a nutshell, the alternative to the lavish praise path, Poe Bronson?
Praise a little less often. Maybe a lot less often, and be careful about using praise as a tool of manipulation. Let praise be what it can be, really just an honest, sincere response to achievements.
Maybe tough for some parents to give it up. It's become a kind of second nature, hasn't it? Do you see that in your circles?
Certainly. It was tough for me to give it up when I began to look into this research. Very tough, Tom. I went through a withdrawal phase, several stages of withdrawal, to try to praise my children not so often and let them make their own conclusions.
Joining us now from Palo Alto, California, is Carol Dweck. She is professor of psychology at Stanford University, been working in this area since 1972 for a very long time. Expertise is in children's learning and motivation. She's author of the book, came out last year, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success. Carol Dweck, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
You sure got Poe Bronson, a father of two, riled up when he started looking at your work. Is this how people respond? They say when they read Carol Dweck, they say, oh my gosh, I've been praising and I've got to stop.
Makes people nervous initially, but it turns their minds around eventually.
So you say you look at patterns of challenge seeking and resilience versus fear of challenge and vulnerability to failure. How does that relate with what you've seen of the way self-esteem is pushed on with our kids?
I have no quarrel with the idea of self-esteem. The problem comes in the way that the self-esteem movement has tried to achieve it. I think self-esteem is about teaching children how to stretch themselves, as you say, how to struggle, how to solve problems and deal with setbacks. Then they can earn the self-esteem themselves as they see themselves progress. It's not about giving them a gift of intelligence praise.
Poe Bronson conveys some of the research you did, some very simple research, but with really head-turning results, where you would take kids, give them a test, take them out of class, talk to them in different ways, send them back in, and then observe how they did. I wish you'd give us just a very thumbnail sketch of that research and what you learned from it, Carol.
Great. Two groups worked on a hard task. One group was told, wow, you got a really good score. You must be smart at this. Another group worked on the same exact task, same kind of kids. Instead, at the end, they were told, wow, you did really well. You must have worked really hard. Then we challenged them. We gave them an even harder task. The students who had been told that they were smart didn't think they were smart anymore. If they were smart when they succeeded easily, they weren't smart when they didn't succeed easily. The kids who had been told, you must have worked hard, thought, this is more challenging. I better work harder or look at another strategy. As a result, the intelligence praise kids crashed. Their performance went way down. And the opposite with the effort praised kids. They remain engaged, involved, interested, and their performance went way up.
So two simple sentences to two groups of kids and very different outcomes on the other side of that. That's just a little piece of a whole lot of research. What is the mindset that you then, Carol Dweck, are encouraging people to try and nurture in their kids, and how do you get to it? What's the message?
The intelligence praise creates what I call a fixed mindset. It makes children believe that there's something deep inside of them called intelligence and that so much rests on it. So they feel, at all costs, I must look smart and not make mistakes. The opposite is a growth mindset, where you teach children that intelligence is something they can cultivate through their efforts. The brain is like a muscle that gets stronger with use.
And they buy that? Kids are that open to the different framing of their own interior life?
Yes. And as a result, then it's about getting smart through learning and application. Kids are fascinated to learn about the brain, to learn that they make their neurons make new connections every time they learn. They feel that that puts them in charge of their minds. It's quite empowering. Mm.
Paul Brunson, I want to hear from you how your own kids are responding to this, but there was a great bit of tape from Carol Dweck, Morning Edition, played it on NPR, but I want to play it again here now. These are kids who have kind of got this message of try hard, work hard, struggle. You can actually build your brain in the process. Let's listen to a minute about how they understood their own minds and abilities after working with Carol.
Your brain does change, of course, just like your personality does. When you're a baby, you can be the most quietest thing. And when you get older, start speaking your mind.
I think that when babies are born, as when they grow and progress, their mind expands and they are able to learn new things.
What I think is my brain was expanding. I think that I was collecting all these things. Every time I saw that, it just put it into my storage and started to expand it. Started to expand it. By now, it's still expanding, but it's now to that point where I can do those things.
When I was little, I know I wasn't using my brain that much because I was just getting to see the world. Where I'm at now, I'm in like a whole advanced level because I was in elementary, now I'm in junior high, and I'm learning advanced stuff.
I'm learning advanced stuff. I love it. And my brain is expanding. Paul Brunson, have you tried the message on your 5-year-old? Is it working? Do you have the courage to stick with it?
It is. And, well, I'll tell you. First, my 5-year-old also has another issue, which is he needs to eat his lunch during the day. He's kind of at an all-day school.
Yeah.
So we've been talking to him about how important is food and water are to your brain. So when I began to talk about the brain as a muscle, we'd kind of already started this brain science thing. Your brain's going to shut down without food and water. And I began to try to tell him, you know, the brain's a muscle and it gets stronger. And we have weight sets in our basement, and he sees his parents kind of do the weights now and then. I wish it was a little more than he does. But and so he understood this idea. But at the same time, I will say that, you know, he's around other parents and other kids, and these other kids are being told, you're smart. You're so smart. And as I began to sort of back off and say, you know, you're not necessarily smart. All kids can get smart if they use their brain on hard things. And I want you to look for hard things.
Right.
I've started to feel like a prisoner's dilemma. Like, what if one day my kid comes home and he says, everybody else's parent tells them they're smart. And how come I'm not smart? You don't tell me I'm smart. I must be an idiot.
So this kind of praise arms race out there you're a little afraid of checking out of.
Absolutely. I was afraid to back away, you know. I had to kind of keep sneaking it in there now and then. If I had to stop, everybody had to stop.
Carol Dweck, how about it? Is that a danger? And do you feel parents who get sort of caught in the praise game afraid to pull out?
Yes, but you don't have to stop praising. Praise can be for something else, appreciating what the child put into something, a drawing. How'd you choose those colors? Or, this is so interesting. How are you solving this problem? Or, I really admired the way you stuck to it and got it. You can really appreciate the process behind what the child is doing and not praise the underlying ability that you think caused it.
Even though that may be the thing parents most want to go to, that intrinsic, praising the intrinsic right there. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let me turn to New Haven, Connecticut, and Rachel. Hi, Rachel. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I'm a university professor who teaches here in New Haven, and I've actually seen firsthand, I think, some of the effects of students who have had, I think, sort of excessive praise. And one of the ways that it manifests itself with these university students is that they're a bit emotionally ill-equipped to handle basic problem solving. They don't really know what to do with the failures that they might encounter in what seem to be pretty simple tasks.
But let me ask you, you're in New Haven, Connecticut. Does that mean Yale? And if the kids are there, haven't they already done pretty well? Maybe the praise worked.
Well, it's actually not Yale.
Okay.
The Southern Connecticut State University.
Great. But in any case, they're there. They're in school. They're in university. And you're saying they're still paralyzed by having heard too much on that line?
I think that I do encounter that actually quite frequently. It's been more frequent as the years have progressed. And what I do notice is that those students who have sort of encountered excessive praise have a tendency to respond automatically to challenges, that they have a sort of set performance level that has worked for them that they think. And when they encounter new challenges and their old sort of set of problem solving is no longer working, I have the tendency to notice them suffering. And oftentimes it manifests in a sort of emotional breakdown.
Carol Dweck, do you recognize what Rachel's describing there?
I certainly do. When students are given easier work all along and praised for everything they do, they are ill-equipped to handle challenges and obstacles. Instead, they need to be taught all along that challenges are what stretch them, make them learn. They need to know that challenges and setbacks are not a sign of low intelligence. They're a sign of, here's something you can learn.
Let's go to Sue in Brockton, Massachusetts. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking this call.
Sure.
I'm in panic right now because I have three children, one a sophomore in college, one a sophomore in high school, and one a sixth grader. And we had a drama yesterday where he just gave up on math and was saying, I can't do this. And I have praised my kids. Please help me find out what I can do to reverse this. Can I tell them, look, I heard a story today that says I might have overpraised you and so you've lost the ability?
Right. Okay, hang on. Let's not panic. But Carol, first to you. Sue's been laying on the... Well, Poe, let me go first to you, if I may. Carol's been laying on the praise button. You must know that feeling. Now you get the Carol Dweck message. Did you panic when you heard it, Poe?
Certainly I had this sense of panic. I had this sense of, you know, Carol Dweck's research is building to a head, and she had a new piece of research from the school in East Harlem that was published last week. But some of her work has been available for years.
Yeah.
And I was floored. I was like, how come I haven't already been told as a parent? You know, the blogosphere should have lit up with
right.
this years ago,
right.
and I should have known. I shouldn't have been telling him he was smart all this time. And backing off was very hard as a parent because I came to see that, you know, offering constant praise was this panacea to the anxieties of modern parenting out of their lives from breakfast to dinner. I really want to turn it up a notch, you know, when I get home. And it was a way to express universal love. You're great. You're innately great.
Right.
There is nothing. You can handle the world,
right.
you know. And it was the way I dealt with my own fears. And Carol really helped me concentrate on equipping him with the specific mentalities. And with my five-year-old, here's how I can say it's gotten better. You know, I mean, he is learning, he is reading, he is doing his math, but he doesn't look at a book that I pull out a book and he doesn't say, I can't do that one anymore.
Right. Okay.
That's why I know it's working better.
Okay. So, Sue, there's the evidence that you're not alone and it can be survived. But, Carol Dweck, what do you say to Sue? She's laid on the praise. Her sixth grader, you know, just sort of checked out of math last night. And she's wondering if she's got it all wrong. Well, what's your game plan?
Well, today, tell that child math is something you learn. Those skills are things you acquire through hard work. Now, let's look at these math problems and go step by step. You can also, when it gets hard, you say, wow, this is a challenge. This is fun. When he makes a mistake, you say, a mistake. What do we do now?
You know, you make it sound so simple, but Sue's looking at this, if I read her right, and thinking, oh, my gosh, I've already, you know, spilled the milk here. I've got this praise bug so deep in him. I've got that to deal with before I can get down to the simple message.
Remember my study. We took children and we gave them one sentence of effort praise. Kids are looking for messages from adults, and if you send them the message, it's interesting. It's something you learn. let's dig in there. Let's have fun with these challenges. They start picking up that message instead.
Sue, are you afraid you're already too far gone?
No, I'm not. I took copious notes, and I'm going to set it to work today. I guess I don't need to be afraid.
Right.
I hope I don't.
Fear not.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Let me know.
Poe?
Tom,
yes.
What Carol's talking about is this role of the parent and the role of the educator. But let's be real here. When I was looking at Carol Dweck's work, one of the things I was struggling and writing about is, does Carol Dweck have a chance in a society in which we're constantly focused on who's the smartest person in the room? Mm-hmm. And people are almost braggarts about how sharp their brain is. And, you don't get hired at Goldman Sachs just because you work hard. There's this culture of celebrating the people with the razor sharp brains. And there is no doubt that Sue's sixth grader has been hearing in the sixth grade classroom, some kids are saying, I'm good at math, and some kids are saying, I'm not good at math. And that message of some are good at math, some are bad at math, and it's innate, is so common. I know because I was told as a young boy, I was good at math, and I was told I was a terrible writer. And yet here I am today, a writer of five books who's so disinterested in math I haven't balanced my checkbook since 1992. it's a hard road to overcome.
Yeah, but effort goes a long, long way. I want to bring another voice in for a moment, if I may, from Baltimore. We've got Bob Younglove with us. He's vice president of the National Association for Self-Esteem. He heads up an initiative called Youth Character and Confidence. Bob Younglove, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom, and thank you for having me on this topic.
So here we are. Do you feel an anti-self-esteem tsunami building here? How does it make you feel as a self-esteem coach, Bob?
No, actually, I'm thrilled to see this much attention being paid to helping parents identify how to communicate the words to use, what to say to empower kids to develop their talent and ability.
So you're reading it as all a path back to the same thing, back to self-esteem. But maybe is that different than efficacy, which may produce its own satisfactions and confidence?
Yes, I think the definition of self-esteem is evolved from those early works back in 1969 that were referred to. The National Association for Self-Esteem defines it as basically the person having the feeling or the experience of being capable of meeting life's challenges and worthy of happiness. So we're very much looking at how we help people face life's inevitable challenges without being overwhelmed or destroyed.
Carol, I believe you've got some samples here, a letter or two from kids who were raised up with all kinds of praise and then found that they ran into trouble. You've called these letters heartbreaking. Can you give us a taste?
Yes, I can. Here's a letter from a man who says, "It was painful to read your work as I recognized myself therein. As a child, I was a member of the Gifted Child Society and continually praised for my intelligence. Now, after a lifetime of not living up to my potential, I'm 49. I'm finally learning to apply myself to a task and also to see failure not as a sign of stupidity, but as a lack of experience and skill." Got another letter yesterday. "I'm 27 years old. As someone who was raised to consider myself, quote, gifted, I read Poe Bronson's article in New York Magazine about your studies on praise with great interest. The characterization of a gifted child as someone who learns to avoid failure resonates strongly with me and with others I've shown the article to. I'd like to find a way to, quote, rewire, unquote, my brain to develop a healthier attitude toward effort and motivation."
Well, so there's direct from the mouths of kids, now adults, looking back on all that. Poe, you're talking about, we've got Bob Younglove here from the National Association of Self-Esteem, but you're saying, have recently, the self-esteem movement is running out of steam, really?
Well, I called a lot of self-esteem researchers who are working in different areas, and I talked to them about Carol Dweck's work and other research on praise. And to be clear, just like Bob was saying, I think what he's saying is accurate, that self-esteem has kind of grown up, and people who are still consider self-esteem to be sort of the secret ingredient, the X factor, they are interested in making sure that it's done right, that kids aren't overpraised to get self-esteem, that kids aren't given empty praise to engineer self-esteem. They're absolutely interested in creating proper self-esteem, like as Carol said, that children come to themselves. And so every self-esteem researcher that I called was able to sort of took a lot of interest in Dweck's work as I described it and wanted to be shown the papers and said that's very interesting and sort of took it and kept going in their own direction. It wasn't like they were running into a brick wall when they hit Dweck, that's for sure. Mm.
Bob, how do you see it? Does it sound to you as though some in the self-esteem movement kind of took it over a cliff?
Well, I think the reshaping of self-esteem is to realize it's simply not just feeling good about yourself without a solid basis. And in Poe's article, he quotes Judith Brook from New York University saying that praise is important, but it has to be based on real things. And I think children, as he mentions in the article, under 7 years of age, may take it more at face value and accept what they hear. But my six-year-old grandson is already questioning what you say to him if he doesn't have it fit his reality. So it has to be very credible. And so I think when you say to a child, you really can work hard at this, you're a good problem solver, you seem to pick things up quickly, you're affirming their ability to learn and develop those skills rather than simply saying, you're smart, you've got it.
So keep it real. Let that self-esteem sit on a real foundation. Bob Younglove in Baltimore at the National Association for Self-Esteem. Thanks very much, Mr. Younglove, for being with us.
May I comment on that?
Yes, of course. Carol, please.
I would not say to a child, wow, you picked that up quickly, because what happens when they struggle?
So
is
what,
that bad?
What do you
Does
say
that mean
then?
They're I would say, you pick that up quickly. Let's go on to something harder.
Always keeping the challenge there.
Yeah, let's take a challenge.
Because one of the things you're saying is that kids who are too praised duck the challenge for fear that it might shake that image, that self-image.
Exactly. And we're so prone to say, you did that quickly, you didn't make any mistakes, that's kind of the holy grail.
Keeps the challenge piece right there. Let me take a call, if I may, Carol, from Augusta, Georgia. Clint, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your panel is correct. I'm an engineer, but I volunteer basketball coach for middle school, and I've been doing this for 18 years.
Good for you.
One of the problems that I have are my parents constantly telling their kids that they're going to be the next NBA player, and they're not that good. And my job as a coach is I have to tell them that they have to hustle, they got to struggle, you got to work hard, just like you have to do in life. My problem is our parents are giving them this high expectation and this praise, and it doesn't have any substance to it. That, in my opinion, we need to tell them the truth to say, this is where you are, and if you want to get here, this is what you got to do. And instead of just saying, oh, that's good, like the young lady said, oh, that's good, and you did a good job, the world needs, in the world, you got to produce. And that's what we need to teach our kids. And we don't do that when we give them the false praise.
Coach Clint, let us pick it up. And we appreciate that. Carol, how do you say that? No, you're not the best. I mean, if praising too highly gets kids a fixed image of themselves, right or wrong, as maybe better than they are sometimes. If you say you're not the best, how do you keep from fixing them with a kind of self-image of mediocrity?
In this growth mindset where you believe your abilities can be developed, kids can hear the truth. You're not there yet, and this is what it takes. I also think the coach needs to hold a workshop for the parents where he explains to them what they're doing and how they're undermining his efforts to help their children improve.
Poe, I think it was you who wrote that sometimes the parents' praise for the kids is, in a weird way, praise for themselves.
That's right. They're so attached to the accomplishments of their children, because the accomplishments of their children reflect back on their skills as a parent, that when they praise their children, they're almost praising themselves. But I dealt with it directly, the coach thing, because this last fall, I was encountering Dweck's research, each week a little bit more, and I was coaching a team of five-year-olds, including my son and many of his friends, and wasn't the only coach. And I began to really change the wording and the language I was using on the field.
Let's hear it.
And, well, rather than just saying, it's great, you all did good, I would say, particularly say to my own son, you did a good job keeping the ball in bounds, because it's very easy for a five-year-old in micro soccer just let the ball go anywhere. And you kept the line in your eyesight and you kept the ball in bounds. Or I noticed you working harder today to get to the ball and be in the play more of the time. Or to another child, you remembered to get back on defense rather than just play on offense. It was very specific, and I really had this compulsion to want to tell all the other parents, you need to change too. We need to empower the kids with the specific skills of doing better at soccer that will build their confidence rather than doing this. And I didn't have the guts to just tell all the parents, I think we're doing this wrong. And the nice thing is, since the article came out, I actually have heard from a couple of the parents saying, I read your article. I was in New York this week.
Okay, I'll tone it down.
Yeah, I'm really changing. And I really noticed that my son was absolutely, he'd walk out on the field and think, I'm not good enough for this. And he would just, he'd want to go to the sideline.
Yeah.
And so I've seen that absolutely play out. And my son this week was asking me, it's this because I'm not coaching his team this season. He said, I think he thought he was the best player. And he'd clearly, I'd never said that to him. No one had ever said that to him. And he's not the best player. And I had to deal with that. I had to honestly say, no, you weren't the best player. I was struggling. I wanted to call Carol. Right. How do I handle this one?
Carol, give us some feedback here. You hear Coach Poe reading you, interpreting, and working to put it into action there. Is he on the right beam by your lights?
Absolutely. And in fact, in my own family, my brother encountered recently a situation where his daughter went to a gymnastics meet. She was devastated that she didn't win, but she wasn't the best. And he told her so. But he also said there are a lot of girls out there who've put in years and years of training. If you'd like to be one of them, that's what you have to do. It's your choice.
It's a funny message in a time when, we hear all the while about how these days the rewards go to the very top. So parents all want their kids to be at the very top. It's not such an easy time in which to hear you're somewhere in the middle. That can sound like a sentence of doom these days. Let's get a call from Nina in Pocasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up as a kid that was praised all the time. I'm 40 years old now. My parents are still praising me. And as I was growing up, with all this praise, I just felt like I never really had to push myself, as if everything would just come to me because I was so smart and so good. My parents never sat me down and said, okay, you're really good at X, Y, and Z, but have you thought about how you can take that forward and be successful with it?
So how did it all work out for you, Nina?
Not terribly well. I did end up going to college. I'm an artist and a sculptor, but I'm certainly not where I would like to be, and I am hardly practicing my art at this point.
And what about in your own, have you become a parent yourself? Have you dealt with kids and tried to do it a different way?
I have not become a parent.
Well, there's still a lot of kids out there to work with, but we hear that there's sort of firsthand testimony from how it can backfire. Nina, thanks for calling. Let me get another from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Catherine's on the line. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air. Catherine, are you there, my friend? Oh, that's breaking up. Let me get another here, I guess.
Hello.
Catherine, have we got you?
Yeah.
Hi.
I just wanted to make one critique of this discussion, which is the assumption that all kids are coming to this equal. I have mixed sons, half black, half white, and what the media is telling them is that black people aren't smart, black people don't succeed, and so for me, it's very important to tell them that they are smart. And the only, I'm not just saying that they're smart.
Right, but at least make sure they know that directly, and you feel for your kids that that's necessary input.
Yes, and I think even earlier in the discussion, they mentioned the kids in D.C. who are in the high school where they had good self-esteem but very poor test scores. I think that's more of a reflection of their environment and the poor quality education that they're receiving, then, you know, then their failure to push themselves because they think that they've got it all already. And I think if maybe we took research further and we saw, okay, how is this impacting these kids who may have not been thinking that they're smart because of societal messages? Maybe they're not making it in high school because of the environment, but maybe that's going to empower them further in life.
Catherine, that's an interesting twist. Let me put it to Carol Dweck. Carol, what about it with kids who may, I don't know, be in some kind of category where they're not given reinforcement by society at large? Is that an exception to your rule?
Well, in our workshop where we taught students the growth mindset, the idea that their brain is like a muscle and gets stronger with learning, many of those children, most of those children were African-American children. And it was the message that they can get smart and get smarter that was empowering, not necessarily the idea that they were already smart. Same with women in math. We found that the women who had this growth mindset were able to withstand those stereotypes and not show deficits in their math performance or decreases in their enjoyment of math.
So you really are focused on the struggle and growing through that. Let me get a call from Kristen in Winchester, Massachusetts. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to call and offer an alternative viewpoint.
Great.
I was raised with my parents also telling me, like a couple of other people that we've heard from, that I was, you know, always so smart and very capable, could do whatever I wanted to do, blah, blah, blah. So I decided when I was about four that I wanted to become a doctor.
Yeah.
And showed up at college completely ill-prepared because I never studied in high school, blah, blah, blah. Bombed my first chemistry exam and wasn't doing so well in my other classes either. But instead of, I actually think that it was the praise I got early that helped me overcome that, because instead of them thinking, oh, my God, maybe I can't do this, maybe
right,
I should think of something else, I sort of thought, well, what's wrong here? I mean, obviously I can do it, so there must be something going on. So
you believed that you had it deep down and you just had to tap it.
Exactly. I just always assumed it was there, and I thought, well, I guess I must not be studying right. And, you know, turned out that that was the case, and made a great comeback, and, you know, now I'm a doctor. So
Kristen, hey, good for you, and congratulations. Carol, how's it figure into your format here? Kristen says she was told this, and it worked for her when the chips were down.
If you think it's fixed and you think you've got it, that can work for a while. If she were confronted with continued setbacks, that could become more of a struggle.
But I'm also hearing here that somehow, I'm guessing, within their praise, they also conveyed to her, you've got to step up and
yeah,
make the effort, because she did.
Yeah.
Poe,
distinction between telling your kid you can do anything by working hard and figuring this out and growing your brain, and telling them you're innately smart. And I struggle with this when I was kicking the tires on Carol Dweck's research. You know, she found this praise effect true in every socioeconomic class, and from preschool, kindergarten, fifth graders, high schoolers. And she even did this work with Columbia and Stanford medical students. And she was finding that those that believed their intelligence was innate had different study habits and didn't perform as well over the course of medical school as students who believed that intelligence was malleable. And so there I was thinking, well, it's even true in Columbia medical students. But the other part of me was thinking, but they still made it to Columbia medical school. It's not like they were held back. And I would ask Carol about this, and she would say, yeah, you know, at Stanford and at Columbia, these kids do have these stereotypes about abilities and the brain that do hurt them, but they kind of figure it out. They're talented enough to figure it out. So I think that's what we're hearing with Kristen. She was talented enough in the end to and worked hard enough at it to figure it out.
Well, and good for her, and good luck to everybody working hard enough for it. We hear a kind of shifting of gears here. It's really fascinating. You've given us a lot to chew on. Carol Dweck at Stanford, author of Mindset. Carol, thanks for being with us this hour.
A pleasure, Tom.
And Poe Bronson, whose piece is in New York Magazine, author of Why Do I Love These People? Poe, always great to hear from you. Thanks for joining
us. Always great, Tom. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.